It's nearly 8 years since the horrendous Black Saturday bushfires that swept through small towns in Victoria in February 2009, Australia's all-time worst bushfire disaster. The fires occurred during extreme bushfire weather conditions and resulted in the nation's highest ever loss of life from a bushfire. 173 people died and 414 were injured. A new longitudinal study released today looks at how the communities affected have adapted, how they've coped 1, 3, 5 years later, and how important to recovery are emotions like anger and when such emotions get in the way. Now, more than 1,000 people took part in the study, and the lead author is Associate Professor Lisa Gibbs, Director of the Jack Brockhoff Child Health and Wellbeing Program at the University of Melbourne. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And also on the line is Jason Gaffey, a policeman from King Lake, one of the small communities destroyed on Black Saturday. Thanks for joining us, Jason.
Hey, good morning to yourself.
Let's start with you, Lisa. To stay or to go, people face this dilemma during the bushfire, but also after it, whether to stay in that community and rebuild or to leave and rebuild somewhere else. Which group is doing better in their mental health 6 years on?
It's such an important question, isn't it? Because we were, you know, spent a lot of time in communities and saw people agonising over this decision. But what we actually found was that the groups that stayed and the groups that moved away were actually about the same in terms of their level of well-being 3 to 4 years after the fires, but for different reasons. So for those who stayed in community, they were more connected to their community, and that was something that impacted positively on their well-being. For those who had left, they had less of that connection to community, but they also had less of the disruption in terms of finances, accommodation, and the stresses that impact relationships as well.
Yeah, that's fascinating, isn't it? Does that resonate with you, Jason?
Oh, it certainly does. And, you know, those community groups are integral to life in the community. Without them, you don't have the links and you don't have the ability to be able to talk to people who have been through the same things as you.
Hmm. You set up an organisation called Smouldering Stump, which is a wonderful rural Australian expression, Smouldering Stump. It sounds like some of my efforts in the kitchen. I don't wish to be flippant about this.
Maybe we need to get you on board.
But you were prompted by your own experience with your two sons and wanting to support children, because adults shush children, don't they, when they need to talk to each other deeply about trauma, and they push the children out of the room. What happens when you invite them back in?
Well, I think what a lot of parents fail to remember or fail to think about is that how children deal with trauma, how they deal with life events, they learn from their parents. So if they're shut out of the conversation by their parents, that's what they will do when, as they grow, they'll shut themselves out of conversations. And so they don't process the information. So it's vitally important that we do concentrate on the children. It's vitally important that schools and preschools are involved in the recovery of children. And that's the aim of the Smouldering Stump, is to provide funds and programs and assistance to children and schools.
And so what do you do? I mean, is it sport? Is it art? Is it drama? How do they make sense of a disaster like Black Saturday?
Everybody copes and everybody recovers in a different way. So if there's 1,000 people affected, there's 1,000 different ways to recover. One of the most exciting projects that we've just started upon, and it's thanks to the kind support of IAG, in conjunction with University of Melbourne and the DAC Centre, is to introduce what's called an ELVA program. And it's not art therapy, but it introduces art into the key educational areas of literacy and numeracy to help kids express themselves and to help improve their learning outcomes. And once they learn and they feel comfortable with their literacy and their numeracy, it starts to break down any barriers they have around their social skills and any deferred learning that may have happened with their social skills.
So you're literally not only saying let's sit down and talk about the bushfire and let's sit down and talk about whether or not with summer on the way this could happen again, but literally some sort of flight and fight thing has happened to these children and they're not learning and they're not socialising as they ought.
Correct. There's a lot of children that have behavioural issues, and they have, they're not as developedly advanced as other kids, and it's as a direct result of not only the trauma they went through, but the learning of dealing with trauma that they got from their family and from their community. They learnt to not be involved. They learnt to stop. They learnt to not engage with people. And so they haven't had the opportunity to get those thoughts and those feelings out and discuss them in the open.
Lisa, in the introduction we talked about the role of emotions. Where does anger come into it? Is anger a useful emotion when adults and children are recovering from this kind of trauma?
Well, absolutely it can be. The emotions are very raw after a trauma event, and it's quite normal to feel angry and you need to express your emotions. The question is how you express them. So we found in talking with people in our interviews, and this was research conducted by one of our PhD candidates, Connie Callett, that anger can be quite useful as a motivator in helping people to get active and start to deal with some of the barriers to recovery. But in our survey findings led by Professor David Forbes, we also found that for people who 3 to 4 years later are experiencing that really explosive, intense anger response to things.
So 3 or 4 years after this event, what happens to them?
Well, if they're still experiencing those explosive reactions, that was associated with poor mental health outcomes. So it was a sign that someone's really struggling and may need some additional support.
Mm. And were men or women more likely to have this, what sounds like post-traumatic stress? Were people who feared for their lives or lost loved ones more or less likely to have these sorts of long-term effects?
Oh, well, there's lots of responses to that. Certainly, men and women had different patterns of impact. Women were more likely to experience post-traumatic stress disorder, but also more likely to report post-traumatic growth. Men and women in their response to anger, they both groups were exhibiting these patterns of behaviour, but it was linked to different things. And, you know, we know that there's so many stressful events that happen after a disaster, and that was associated with anger responses. But the explosive anger and the impact this has on poor mental health was over and above those disruptions.
But can anger ever be a motivator to recovery?
Yeah, sure. It's when people are trying to drag themselves out of bed to get something moving, being angry can actually be quite useful in standing up for your rights, in trying to push through where regulation might be slowing you down or things moving slowly. But when it gets beyond that, when it's not something that you can control, that's when it's a sign that perhaps things aren't going so well for you.
And you were talking about post-traumatic growth. What does that mean?
Well, this is something that's been observed now in many different forms of crisis events, that where people report that the massive changes that have occurred as a result of that event actually can have some positive outcomes as well. And this is even for people who had intense loss. And so it's important for us to monitor that and understand how that works, because I found that people were reluctant to speak of that out of respect for those that were still struggling.
Mm. And what about you, Jason? I mean, by its nature, routine police work must take a toll, and a disaster like Black Saturday would take it to a whole other level. How have you and your family, the boys, come through the Kinglake experience?
Oh, I guess I'm lucky in some respects that that through my employment I've been exposed to critical incidents and trauma across my career. And so that gave me a really good handle on how I manage myself. And because I was able to manage myself, I could focus my attention more so on my family and the wider community and give them the benefit of my experience. So, you know, my boys and my wife, we had some really good conversations in the period immediately after, and still do as we go on.
So tell me what happened to you that day, your family.
Well, my wife and boys were at home and I was on my way home from work, and I had a phone call from my wife saying that the fire was there and that they were leaving, and then the phone cut out. And for the next 7.5 hours, I had no idea where they were. It turns out that they had gone to the local CFA to seek shelter after they had driven through the fire front. And I had driven through the fire front on two occasions trying to get home to find out where they were. And then I pulled over to the side of the road and chastised myself and said, well, you're an idiot. If you keep doing this, you will never find them because you'll be one of the statistics on the side of the road. So I actually went to work and busied myself with work while I set up a safe way to go and find where they were. And I was extremely lucky that by my side during that day and that evening, I had one of my lifelong friends with me from work, and she was able to be the yin to my raging yang, I guess, and keep me focused and keep me safe.
Mm, and keep you sane. 7.5 hours. Did your wife and children know where you were?
They knew that I was trying to get home, and my wife said to me afterwards that she knew that I would busy myself with work until I could get there to help them.
Yeah. And she knew you were safe? She didn't know you weren't?
When she rang me, I was safe. It was the interim that that I probably took some risky behaviour that, in hindsight, I probably wouldn't do again. Mm. But that's part of learning.
I can imagine you sitting up bolt upright in bed and screaming that 7.5 hours echoing through right down to your old age. What impact did it have on the boys?
They're much better. Immediately after the fires, we you know, some of the things that we did to help them make sure that they were included in the recovery was that we all slept together on two mattresses in the lounge room to make sure that they felt comfortable and they felt safe.
How long did you do that for?
I think it was about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And that was part of that was so that things like sunrises and sunsets with their really vibrant reds used to upset the boys early on.
And
so
how old were they at that stage?
What were they, 11 and 9.
Yeah, keep going. And, so that used to upset.
And so, yeah, it was those vibrant colours. And so as a family, we were able to sit there together and watch them and see the beauty that's in that sunrise and that sunset and change the way they were thinking. You know, other things like when we had our first fog set them into a panic because they thought it was smoke. So it's little things like that that you pick up along the way. And as long as you talk to them and you're honest and you're open, and they know that it's okay to be sad. They know that it's okay to be happy. My youngest, Brock, lost his best friend in the fires. So we talked through those things. We told them that no emotion's off the table. They're all normal and they're all natural. But what you need to do is keep moving forward and not stagnate.
And how do they approach the coming summer?
I would say that they're back to where they were pre-2009, and they're aware of the dangers of where we live, but they're also aware of the benefits of where we live, and we choose to live there as a family, and that's knowing full well that each year there could be a bushfire. What we had that day wasn't a bushfire, it was a wildfire, and they're completely different. Sometimes knowledge gives them the confidence to know that as a family we can get through these things.
My guests are Associate Professor Lisa Gibbs, Director of the Jack Brockhoff Child Health and Wellbeing Program at the University of Melbourne, and we're hearing the personal story of Jason Gaffey, a policeman from Kinglake and the chair of Smouldering Stump, which supports young people. Lisa, very interesting, heart-rending really, listening to how Jason and his wife helped these two children through this trauma. Is it helpful for people who've left the area to reconnect with their old neighbours, people like Jason, and hear those sorts of stories of healing and moving forward with lives?
Look, it certainly can be. We have to be guided by individual needs and as Jason said, everyone has a different style of recovery. But the shared processing of the event and the aftermath does seem to be a helpful part of the process, and those who have moved away do often miss out on that, and so it can take a bit longer to just work through the experience. So those connections can be really important.
And that's one of the recommendations, I believe, is this to help reduce stress of this loss of contact after the disaster. How would that occur?
Well, one of the things that we really are recommending is to establish a communication register, because where services are delivered into the communities affected, it's pretty straightforward. They're provided locally. Locally, people are aware of what's available. But for those who move away, they lose that connection to what's being delivered and what might be available to them. So the communication register would be a really important way of enabling people to access services outside of community.
Mm. And Jason, there's also recommendations for more support for parents, you know, so they have time to deal with bureaucracy and rebuild. But I want you to comment just finally on this one. One of the recommendations is to prioritise the return of the natural environment as important to mental health. That is restoring community parks, restoring the natural environment. How does that help, Jason?
I think when people see the environment being rehabilitated, they start to feel better about themselves as well. So you're talking about people who live in these areas because they like the environment and they find it relaxing or they find it restful. And so as the environment is rehabilitated, it helps them feel better about where they are and why they're there. And it helps them move forward.
Mm. And when you look out after 8 years across the landscape that was Smouldering Stumps, as you call your support group, and folks can find it on Facebook, what do you think, and what do the boys think, and what do your wife think on an early morning when you look out across the area where you live at the bush regenerating?
I would never, ever guess what my wife's thinking.
Wise man. What do you think?
But I look across. We're lucky. We live on the side of a hill, and we look across an absolutely magnificent view. And every morning we get an absolutely magnificent sunrise. And I think, why would I live anywhere else?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing your personal story, Jason.
No worries. Thank
Jason
you.
Gaffey, he's a policeman from Kinglake and the chair of Smouldering Stump. You can find that on Facebook, facebook.com/thesmoulderingstump. And the Bushfire Report Associate Professor Lisa Gibbs is the director of the Jack Brockhoff Childcare and Wellbeing Program at the University of Melbourne. And we'll put that report, Lisa, on our website. Thanks for joining us.
That's great. Thank you.
And you're listening to Life Matters.